Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. All right, welcome to the Are You Serious Show number 21. We are now 21. We are old enough to vote.
Legal.
We can drink in most states. Actually, when I was growing up, it was 18.
I know, me too.
In New York and in most states. I remember I was hitchhiking across the country when I was 20, and I went into this place, and I couldn't get a drink, and I was astonished. I was like, my mouth dropped wide open. It was like telling me I couldn't masturbate on the street. I mean, who
would stop you?
Who could believe this sort of thing? Anyway.
You mean you were already legal whenever the law went into effect? So
I was legal. I was legal in New York, where the age was 18, but I was hitchhiking across the country, and I was in Nevada. And I went into a bar, and I was simply shocked.
Illegal.
Shocked that
And
disappointed that there would be such a law. Anyway. We are 21. This is the 21st show, and we're really excited to have Larry Harvey, the burning man himself, coming in.
Master Burn.
Exactly. So stay tuned, hang out, and we've got Jeff Deal with us, and
partly.
Diana Scooter Brown is here.
Scooter.
Welcome, Diana Scooter
My
Brown.
My new moniker as Scooter. Okay. I feel like a 50s talk show, you know, like some 50s family program. G-pop!
Exactly. Anyway, welcome, Diana.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this.
Step right up.
So, yes, I was reading on Boing Boing, the National Academy of Sciences and the National Science Teachers Association have decided they're not going to allow the state of Kansas to use key science education materials that's been developed by these two organizations. Apparently, they feel that the school board in Kansas will inappropriately single out evolution as a controversial theory. And they're not the only state doing this. But the decision has not been made. Boing Boing actually said that they feel that using this is at the expense of scientific method and free speech. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it does seem to be a sort of an anti-free speech maneuver. Obviously, I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that there was a poll recently that showed that 51% of Americans don't believe in evolution.
They believe the world was created 10,000 years ago.
By God, despite all that. And then an additional 35% believe in evolution but also believe in God.
Right.
So, I mean, this fascinates me. And it is a desperate situation, but I think that Boing Boing is correct. That,
yes.
The scientists and the writers of material ought to stand on the principle of free speech and the distribution of free material and allow religious nuts to critique it before school children in any way which they please.
Well, isn't the act of a school board dictating what and how a teacher teaches also a violation of free speech?
I think that's a great point.
You're being razzed by your own doorbell here.
Yeah, wrong answer.
Well, public schools, obviously, they have an administration, and those administrators have certain rights. So, I mean, one can question the whole presence of the government in education, like the libertarians do, for instance.
Yes.
In which case, it would be up to whoever owns the school to dictate what the children learn. And then some people feel that parents have the right to do anything they want with their children.
It's hard for me to sympathize about the free speech of basically what amounts to propaganda.
Well, I mean, that's what free speech is everybody has the right to
Now, representative.
Spout propaganda. Of course, the children are in public school, so in another sense, the children are captives. yeah, of the government.
Yeah. Does the government have a right to spout propaganda and have that protected by free speech?
Well, again, I think what we're talking about is their ability to use these materials, and we don't know exactly how they're going to use these materials.
Actually,
they're going to separate them off into two different things, and they're going to teach the evolution.
No, they wanted to grab actual copy from these texts, I think, and place them in the books, and now they're going to have to reword it and water it down.
Well, that's exactly right.
That was Cory Doctorow's.
So in some ways, they're just needing permission from an author to use their material. So in that sense, they may have.
But a spokesperson,
they may have the right to make those choices.
A spokesperson from the school board says they plan to paraphrase the parts taken from the two organizations, and that would technically make the copyright issue a moot point. So they're looking for a loophole.
You can't stop the march of devolutionary anti-progress. All right, we are back. We're here with the father of our country, man, Larry Harvey, the main man behind the Burning Man gathering, probably the coolest cultural revolution that ever emerged from a guy who was depressed about his girlfriend leaving him, at least since Marianne Leary committed suicide in 1955. He launched Burning Man in 1986, and if you don't know about it by now, you've been living in a cave. And in fact, if you've been living in a cave, you might be the sort of weird nonconformist person who would like to go to Burning Man. So you're hearing about it here first.
Woo!
Burning Man. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
All right. So you moved to San Francisco from what I understood from your biography, which I might not have understood that well. You were already about 30 years old. What was up during your 20s? What were you into? What were you up to?
In my 20s, I was hiding in the forest.
Really?
In an obscure place. A part of it spent in Coquille, Oregon, which is near Coos Bay, Oregon, which at that time boasted the largest wood chip pile on Earth.
Really?
Yes.
Is this a roadside attraction, like the largest
Well, I don't
swine?
Think it exists anymore. I think they whisked those wood chips away now for other purposes.
So you were hanging out among the chips?
And reading a lot. It was a tiny town. And spending a lot of time in nature.
So what was your, I don't know, sensibility? Did you have an artistic inclination?
I missed the 70s.
Really?
I missed the disco balls.
No cocaine?
I never rode a mechanical bull.
Oh, damn.
No.
No glam rock?
I never attended a concert. I never danced.
Really? So you weren't a hippie or anything like that?
No, I'd been a hippie. I'd been a hippie a little, late in the 60s. And,
yeah.
Or rather, I'd moved among the hippies.
You hung out with the hippies.
I knew the hippies.
In a small town.
I passed for a hippie. Yeah. Oh, no, I'd been up here before then. I'd come up. I was here in the Spring of Love and in San Francisco, and then came back for the Fall of Love and was witness to the Winter of Love.
How was the Winter of Love?
I heard the Spring of Love was really
Winter of Love was rough. The people from finally, the hippies went back to their middle class origins, and they were replaced by people who had actually grown up sleeping on the floor.
Very different.
And they were different because they carried the guns and shot heroin. And
it's better than shooting guns and DMZ.
That's what I understand, that everybody left and moved out to the sunset.
They moved to Marin. They went to Noe Valley and bred at
the rock stars
a rabbit-like rate. They went to
the farm in
Bolinas,
Tennessee.
They went to the farm in Tennessee. There was a diaspora that occurred. There was the communal movement. Mm-hmm. And Bolinas was filled with hippies at that time because there had been an oil spill, and they went there and wouldn't leave.
They cleaned up the geese and stayed.
Yeah.
Would you say you were like really involved in this, and then you sort of went back and forth between being a loner and being
well, I had just got out of the army when I came down the first time. Right. When I came down, actually, the first time
you didn't go to
still
Nam,
in high
did you?
School. Oh, no. When I came down the first time, I was still in high school, and this was before the hippies had actually emerged or were just perhaps just emerging.
Right.
And then did a very brief stint in the service and came back to see it in full uproar. All you had to do was take off your shoes.
And you were there.
And
it was really don't trust anyone who wears shoes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was basically.
You could be over 30, but you couldn't wear shoes.
One day I and my girlfriend actually put shoes on. In fact, I put on a suit and she put on. We were going to the bank to get the check, of course. And it was amazing how love quit the scene.
People wouldn't relate to you.
Oh, it was not a place of love and acceptance. Love did not beam and bead around us. It was quite interesting. And I believed during that period, substance I won't name, for 15 minutes at Hippie Hill.
At Hippie Hill.
As I peaked. That love would radiate out from that place, that instant, and roll through all things, and change the world. And then
it happened, baby man.
I was raised by people from Nebraska, and after 15 minutes, I said to myself, "No, I'd seen too much already. I'd seen the economics of the underground dope market and how it was really like the economics of above ground capitalism."
Funny like that.
Oh, there was no critique going on whatsoever that I could see, and we were just a big dumb age cohort who wouldn't listen to anybody except ourselves, and we didn't know very much. I know that's a harsh critique. You know, some of my best friends are hippies. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to the current or the local past, the Burning Man.
Yes.
Which is kind of like a homebrew pagan ritual. It's a participatory art happening. It's
don't
a community.
Say pagan. Please don't say
okay,
pagan.
Well, this is the thing. You don't like to define it, but you do emphasize community.
Well,
but anybody can go to it, and you don't have to be,
be a pagan and come to it.
You can be a pagan. You can be a situationist. You can be a Microsoft executive. You can be just about anything. You can come.
Yeah. Except antisocial. That might trip you up.
So, I mean, at some point, does there reach a point where there is an exclusion? Is there anybody who needs to be excluded from this, or how does it remain a community without exclusion?
Well, if you assault someone or steal from someone or commit a felony, you're no longer welcome there. You are welcome in the county jail, and if you get caught, you'll go there. other than that, it takes a great deal to get ejected. Every view, a very, very, very few individuals are escorted to the gate.
Yeah. And, what kind of things do they generally do? The things
A kid years ago. He's fabled now. He was taking a class. It was a trust fund kid at the Art Institute.
Aren't they always?
And he decided that he would show that we were hypocrites by pushing radical self-expression to its limits, showing that we were the man, we were the repressive state. And so he came there with a megaphone and began to insult his neighbors and anybody who walked by in the grossest terms. And this went on for 3 days. And for two of those days, our rangers were protecting him from his neighbors, which shows how far one must go. And still he hadn't found that boundary, so he began to hector a gentleman walking by with his young daughter, and describing to him what he would do to his what sexual acts he would perform on the little girl, and at which point, rather than let the neighbor hit him with a frying pan as he'd been threatening to do for 2 days,
just the frying pan,
we escorted him to the gate, and afterwards, he was heard to say, "You don't understand. I won." He dropped out of the Art Institute, I'm told, and he probably found it an oppressive regime.
That place was putting him down too.
Preyed upon the life of the people, but. And then his friends stayed on. They were heard to say, "Oh, bummer, do. We were going to have our CD release party. And then the next night, the camp burned down. And nobody to this day knows whether they set it on fire, the neighbor set it on fire, somebody set it on fire. And in any case, it was no public menace. It was promptly put out. And that was the end of Capitalist Pig Camp. So that's what you have to do.
There is this interesting thing about boundaries and free communities, and the fact that they do work to the extent that they do these days, not just like at Burning Man, but online, things like Wikipedia and so forth. Mm-hmm. There seem to be less people like wanting to come out and be willfully destructive, and more people wanting to be part of sort of a mutually creative collaborative effort. Do you see this as an evolution in our culture? Do you think this is really going on, or am I just imagining
it? It's an evolution in our city. I don't know about the culture in general. It seems to be becoming less civil in some ways.
Yeah, but I mean, at least within like tech culture, net culture. Yeah, I mean, it's like when you used to go for on community bulletin boards. You know, mostly it was like people flaming and like.
Well,
coming
they still do resemble toilet stalls.
Well,
know?
Yeah, but it's gotten a lot better. There's a lot less, you know, people just fucking things up.
You think
up.
So, really? I'd like to believe that.
That seems to be,
I would like
you
to
know,
that too.
I could be wrong. Anyway, let me ask you this. I mean, we did this thing, counterculture panel together, and one of the charms that a lot of people see in Burning Man is its lack of definition and lack of purpose. But you seem to express a strong sense of purpose at this point, that Burning Man has something to give to the world in terms of community, in terms of people doing this and making it more part of their lives. Do you want to talk to that a little bit?
Well, we never dictated a purpose, literally we never dictated assigned officially a meaning to the man. That doesn't mean we were purposeless. It meant that we would rather people achieved, say, in the instance of the man, if they wanted to invest the figure with the symbolic meaning, that they achieved that through their experience, through their actions. What we've seen emerge, though, over time is it is what we now style an ethos. But an ethos, unlike an ideology, is the immediate product of lived experience that's shared with others, whereas ideologies tend to be dictated from without. And that's a crucial distinction, because one is propaganda and the other one is evidence of culture. And that has definitely happened. I mean, I play the role of a leader, but if I sounded a wrong note in the culture that we've evolved, I don't think anyone would blindly follow me. I spent a lot of time seeing what I have my own ideals, and I've certainly worked to create contexts where people might discover certain values, but it's their discovery to make, and it seems that they've made it. All one does sometimes as a leader is you pay a great deal of attention to the nature of the experience of folks, and then you try to articulate it at that moment when they really begin to feel it. It's just like a good music track in a movie, a really good music track, as opposed, say, to a Ron Howard movie. A good music track doesn't tell you what to feel. It expresses what you feel half a beat after you felt it. And what the people who come to the event, I think, are beginning to feel is that there is a coherent ethos that's emerged that has multiple applications to everyday life.
So you spoke about spreading this in some ways, of doing more than just the one-year festival. But let's break, think about that for a second, and we'll break for some music and be right back.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
We're back. I started to ask Larry about some plans for moving Burning Man beyond just the one event every year over Labor Day in the desert. You do have some plans, right?
Well, we have plans, but really the first point to make is that we didn't really begin with that plan, and indeed our plans are a result, at least half of our plan is a result of what the community itself has done spontaneously. Mm-hmm. We have a regional network, but it didn't happen, nor did we dream to form it until the participants who had gone home and came back to us and said, we wanted to meet with one another. Can you make a list?
Right.
And that was their spontaneous impulse at work. It wasn't our master plan.
Right. I mean, it's almost inevitable that when people get together at something like this and have a great
experience. Like this, yeah.
They're going to start forming.
Consumer spectacle. Yeah. It's not very likely at all. But so as initiatives have evolved within the communities and our own experience of the event, my experience and my fellow planners' experience of the event has evolved as we've meditated on it, a kind of plan that reflects what the community is doing has emerged. I'll give you an example of a spontaneous thing. It's very recent. The event this year happened during the Katrina disaster.
Right.
And so people very naturally started collecting a fund. In fact, it amounted to, I don't know, $35,000. And, well, that was nice, and we assigned part of it to the Red Cross and gave part of it to Oxfam and then held part of it back because we knew the various members of groups within the community were going down there to see what they could do. And, but we held it back to see how they succeeded. We took a Darwinian approach to it. Some ended up refugees themselves. But one group that was supremely qualified, in fact, was made up of both members of our Department of Public Works, DPW, and the group that builds the temple every year that commemorates the dead, and the temple crew, they're called. They happened onto a Vietnamese community in Biloxi, the center of whose spiritual life was their temple, which had been blown away.
Right.
And, well, they just finished building a temple in a howling wilderness in northern Nevada.
Right.
And they knew how to do these things. And so they started building a temple for them. And the federal agency, what are those
FEMA?
People called? FEMA, yes. FEMA hadn't even shown up. No one had shown up. Yeah, when FEMA did come, they said, oh, my God, thank God, someone's here who has a grip on things, and began to rely upon them.
Right.
And so then, you know, we began to fund them. Now suddenly a member whose name should, at least for now, should be anonymous, I think we can announce it soon, resides in Southern California, said, I'll give $50,000 to the DPW. I don't need a deduction. I just give it to them. Then we spent 2 weeks dithering about whether our nonprofit or the Black Rock Arts Foundation or how we would handle it with the tax implication. And then I realized that we were behaving like FEMA. We were getting in the way, trying to solve an administrative question, and we just stepped aside and let the man give it to the people who were actually doing the work.
Right.
And now that's something that we had a hand in helping to happen. We publicized it on our internet. A couple people who worked for us took their own time off and went down there and helped to organize. Indeed, the crew that was working on the temple had learned their skills at our event and very much part of our community. But I would say that it's the community that initiated that action. And it's we then who used our central position to help them to succeed and to help others to help them.
Right. So in some sense, it's a spontaneous, emergent kind of property of your community that, you know, this little sliver kind of went off and
that
and
actually
solved,
embodied nearly every part of our ethos: radical self-reliance, communal action, cooperative effort. They were building. They were doing essentially the same thing they did in the desert. They're building a temple.
I mean, are people forming livelihoods in some ways around?
Well, there are interesting things that people are starting to do. We're watching it. We're very jealous of the trademark Burning Man. We won't let the name be exploited. That's why you don't see any Burning Man mouthwash on the market. But on the other hand, we're like any good community. We're pretty tolerant in the way we manage things, and so we're open to what people might do. There's a group in Seattle that started an enterprise called the Static Factory, and that was interesting. It was capitalism, in fact. Of course, we never said we were against capitalism or commerce. Some people have the idea that we're Luddites.
It seems like all kinds of people
demonize commerce, you know, and they're ready to demonize us. They don't demonize themselves, because of course they have to make a living. But of course that's an absurd position. To be against commerce is to be against civilization, is to be against this radio program, is to be against the clothes you're wearing, is to be against everything but eating grubs.
Well, anybody who's against this radio program deserves to die.
And eat grubs and die in that order. And nor do I necessarily think that command economies are the greatest thing in the world.
Burning Man itself is kind of, you described the gift economy, which in some ways I think may be the next
level
of evolution. The gift
economy can lead to, listen, any sacred thing, observance, ritual, rite, since the beginning of time has tended to celebrate things that a community feels have unconditional value. Mm-hmm. And the sacred spaces are places outside the world. The Black Rock Desert very much feels like a place outside the world. And we decided that it would be a place where all actions have an unconditional value. And we translated that into economics and said a gift is something that is unconditional, mm-hmm. since no return can be expected of a proper gift. Show me somebody who was raised badly, and it's probably because their parents wanted a return. We said that, and we said that has spiritual value unto itself. We never said that you could lead your life that way. How would you like to be in a world where if you wanted a stick of gum, you have to form a relationship with somebody that would tend to limit your existence in ways that would limit your liberties in terrible ways in the end. But the spirit of a gift, once understood, is being the base, it being the essential values that all other values should in some way serve. Well, no, that makes sense. Look at what they did, and you know, rather than mistake the letter of a law for the spirit of a gift, look at what they did in Seattle. They started a business. Well, they need capital. Of course, we never had any capital, but we do things the hard way. Yeah. And these were kids.
You didn't know where you were going with
this.
Well,
we were bohos who learned business, and they were kids who'd been taught business at school, and then learned about being a boho. Mm-hmm. Out in the desert, so they knew they needed capital, but they put it together. It grew out of a theme camp. They put it together as you would a theme camp. Well, they're up there in Bill Gates' land, and there are all these people who have some money and who were burners, and who were willing to invest in their enterprise. But they were not investors; they were breathing down their neck, looking for fat profits, and telling them that they must do only those things that will result in profit, because that strips those things of value within any culture away remorselessly. So they were managed to do a kind of community-based fundraising, and what they created was a place where you could go for a drink, you could go for dinner, they had studios for a recording, studios for photography, and a community gathering place, a culture-bearing enterprise. Uh-huh. A culture-bearing enterprise. Well, I don't see, now, if I thought commerce were the great Satan, I suppose I'd denounce that. That seems to me a humanized form of commerce, indeed a fairly humanistic approach to capitalism. And
or you could see it as an appropriation of capital, and then an alternative use for it that isn't.
Why not appropriate the world's tools, but use them to a spiritual purpose? The problem with the world right now is any kind of spiritual purpose has been drummed out of everything, because every possible transaction has been commodified in our world.
Yeah, and my point is though that strictly speaking, that project in itself was maybe not essentially commercial. You know what I mean?
I don't think it wasn't essentially commercial. But they wanted to create something meaningful to them. They had to use economic tools, financial tools to do it. When I saw what they were doing, I was going to tell them stories about our past, and I realized I'd lose authority because we'd look so stupid. But I did very much appreciate what they were doing and let them know that. And
what's
lately,
the name
I've
of the
been telling anybody. It's a place called the Static Factory.
Oh, right. Static.
Now, I mean, I don't guarantee. Who knows how that sustains through time? That has let you.
These
you
things
have to
come
guessing.
And go very, very.
And who knows? I don't know. I won't claim to know that part. But having seen it created, and having seen it thrive, and having seen it gain the adherence of the community there, and produce good things thus far, I think that suggests how that sort of thing could be elaborated on an everyday basis, and at the rate things are going in this country.
Yeah, let's talk a minute about that, the way things are going in this country, and if there's a Burning Man or a Larry Harvey approach to the way things are going. And I'm afraid this will be your final shot for this Are You Serious show, mm-hmm. although Larry Harvey will be back with us very soon, and it'll seem right away to him.
I heard he might, yeah.
He will. We know.
So what's the question?
Good question.
In this segment, you come up with your
own
question.
You're talking about the current, you're beginning to refer to the current sort of political reality in America.
The way things are, and how,
if you have any plans to take that on in some sense.
I think the captain in his wheelhouse is sleeping at his watch. I don't think anyone thinks
he's sleeping in his crib.
I think America is going to listen. If regardless of what people might think of George Bush, I think he's done us a bit of a favor. A man like Clinton could have convinced the world that we were all powerful and convinced us that we were truly wealthy for another 10 years. Bush is pulling the veil away on a rather ugly reality, and it's going to be very painful. And unless we experience pain sooner than later, then later on it's going to be it could be traumatic. And I don't want that to happen because I love this country.
So let's
bring the pain on now.
All right, so George Bush is the disease coming on.
Well, you never know. You know, a bad thing can produce a good thing. I've seen a good thing produce a bad thing. It's hard to know.
It is hard to know. I want to thank Larry Harvey. Maybe we'll extend this for another few minutes. And
if
let
we
Jeff,
can, that'd be
Jeff
nice.
Get
I just,
his question.
I wanted to ask you about Chicken John and a little bit about the division between the people who, I don't know, the community –
let me interview.
Group and the art group and what happened since the last Burning Man, if anything has happened as a result of that, the dialogue
progressed.
Chicken John or Chicken Con?
Chicken John, John Rinaldi is my good friend.
That's what I understand.
So there's never been any. There was never any division between us.
It's always seemed like a very humane debate. I'll say that much. I was impressed by.
Well, not in its initial phases. I wouldn't say that actually, having been denounced as an evil pope and having some of my colleagues.
One should always be denounced as an evil pope.
We'll denounce you later, are you? So you don't feel left out.
And so forth. There was a great deal of thunder, lightning, and smoke, and few mirrors along at the birth pangs of that movement, and much heat and less light, but it did emerge as a kind of discourse in the end, and largely owing to Chicken John. To put it in perspective, this is a San Francisco, phenomenon. It's heralded as being of world consequence, and it turned out to be. Less than that, but I know this because my girlfriend went over to the camp it's impolitic of me to say this, but I will say it anyway.
Chicken John's camp?
Went over to the camp, and they were it was to greet the artists afternoon. And there was one person there. You could, you know, hear the tumbleweeds. And, and she said, "Wait, where's the event?" And the woman said, "Oh, they all got dates," and took off. Oh, I could have told you that. But,
the cause fell to romance.
And
what's the eighth line of great something or other signifying nothing?
Well, you see, I don't want to make enemies anew.
We all make good friends and we made
common cause. But if you're looking for a group of people to create, to invent democracy, I wouldn't go to anarchists for that. Because there's certain underlying tensions that inhibit that from happening. And the woman looked up appealingly at my girlfriend and said, after telling her that everyone had gone on a date, and I'm only quoting what I was told, and said, "Do you want to volunteer?" And yet they did fund three or four artworks, perhaps more. I would be willing to be corrected. That did appear on the Playa. And that was good. That was a good thing. And they raised money themselves. It was a good thing. They voted. I followed their election. The election itself, and I'll glide over that. And I think that everybody had a good time.
All right, so this is kind of, it's inside Burning Man politics. It'll mean something to a portion of our audience.
Yes.
And
yes,
but anyway, I mean, there was a dissident group just for our audience. Chicken John was sort of identified with the, and by the way, we asked Chicken John if he wanted to come on the show right after Burning Man.
I congratulated him for his
show. And he said that I'd have to call him the day before the show,
congratulated him at the time for reviving the venerable tradition of barroom politics in America. Absolutely. Which I felt had lapsed. You know, it just goes back to Samuel Adams. And
literal barroom.
And I would put Chicken John in that lineage. I would.
All right. Well, thank you, Larry Harvey from Burning Man, for coming in and talking to us. And let's talk again in about 30 seconds.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Republicans, Republicans, I chant with my arms in the air, entering the concourse of the state Republican convention, a conservative's wet dream splattered with Bush Cheney signs, filled with a white and very white crowd, milked with big hair and fat cats resembling Thurston Howell from Gilligan's Island. To fully infiltrate this faction, I've adopted a blue suit, American flag tie, and cunning conservative disguise, and joined the Silicon Valley branch of the Young Republicans. Going by the conservative name Chet, is there anything more nauseating than to be young, pumped up, and Republican? The Young Republicans really like to party, the YR president, a former Marine, tells me in the lobby. You'll party like you never partied before. I'm sure he's right, because I've never partied Young Republican style. Unlike their wussy liberal counterparts, the Young Republicans love to drink, and there's plenty of free alcohol. Remember, who's the biggest party boy of them all? In fact, my club, the Silicon Valley Young Republicans, is throwing a party in our hotel suite. The best part is, I volunteer to be on the party planning committee. I even handed out flyers earlier with a big guitar on it reading, "Just follow the music." "Who wants a silver bullet?" cries the middle-aged suited fat man with a can of Coors in each hand. Who the hell is this guy? Though appreciative of free alcohol, it's a sad bunch comprised almost entirely of young Republican males standing stiffly in a corner waiting for other conservatives to show up. Basically, it's a Republican pickle party. It's like a mini frat party, but with a patriotic theme. To create the proper party atmosphere, some decorating genius came up with the idea of putting the American flag on one wall, a large Silicon Valley Young Republicans banner on the other wall, and a Bush Cheney sign in the middle. Yeah, let's party. The Eagles' "Life in the Fast Lane" blares from a sound system as a young Republican does some mean air guitar. We stand uncomfortably in the corner, passing the time by bashing Democrats. "Kerry looks like Herman Munster," remarks a man with a protruding forehead. "Yeah, and Hillary Clinton, she looks like an ape," I interject, a huge young Republican laughs. Some pass the time by watching Fox News while rigid dancing is attempted by one of the whitest crowds I've ever seen in suits, who possess no rhythm whatsoever. Horny guys salivate over the very few women in the room. As drinks pour, the young Republican president starts yelling at some poor random girl, accusing her of stealing a can of Coors, and makes her cry. More Eagles music plays. Every new person I meet, I give a hearty slap on the back and proclaim, "We're all family! We're all Republicans!" After taking a Jell-O shot, I have the uncanny desire to get busy with one of the rare few female young Republicans and go to the dark side. You know, I'm president of the San Francisco chapter of the Young Republicans, I boast, hoping she'll want to use me tonight to climb up my political ladder. After telling me she works for a non-profit, I proclaim, "Wow, almost sounds like you're a Democrat." She looks at me like I just called her a pedophile and quickly walks away. I'm still rapidly climbing the ranks of the club as the president passes me off to a new clean-cut recruit to tag along with me so I can share all the glorious benefits of being a young Republican. "We're all family, we're all Republicans," I stress, slapping him hard on the back, while Republicans take turns singing patriotic karaoke such as "Let the Eagles Soar." "You gotta join the Young Republicans," I express. "It's really a great opportunity to be amongst like-minded people." "Yeah, it sounds great," he replies. "I'm also president of another club," I say, moving in closer. The new recruit expresses interest. He asks the nature of the club. I explain further. "Our club's purpose is to promote the advancement of white people." "So what do you say?" The new recruit's face turns whiter than a Klansman's sheet. He declines. He quickly walks away. That's one less young Republican. Oh well, as our beloved President Bush would say, mission accomplished. Okay, I'll be at Booksmith November 5th for the release of my new book, Republican Like Me, Infiltrating Red States, White Ass, and Blue Suits, 7 p.m.
We'd like to thank Larry Harvey and Harmon Leon for coming into the studio today. The music you heard was "Wacko Macko Is Backo" by Electro Organic Sound System. Next week, V. Vale from Research Publications will join us to talk about his latest books with British novelist J.G. Ballard. The Are You Serious Show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Subscribe to all of our shows at mondoglobo.net. And listen up! The Are You Serious Show and Mondo Globo are looking for volunteers to join us on our excellent adventure. People working in sound, video, event organizing, just about any skill that can be applied to a media company, please get in touch. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.